Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of the We're Not Experts History Podcast with myself, Sarah, and James. Hello, James.
Hello, Sarah. Hello, Sarah. Hello, listener.
Listeners. I'm sure we have hundreds of listeners. But, well, maybe a few. But anyway.
If it's bubble figures, I'll be shocked.
Well, who knows? I'll have to check the stats. But anyway, what do you have for us today? Because it's your turn.
Well, today I am going to tell you and our listener, singular, about two French artists and what they got up to.
Okay.
I don't want to give too much away straight away, but the two French artists are two women,
right,
called Lucie Schwab and Suzanne Malherbe, who were born in the 1890s in France.
Right,
but
okay.
They weren't just artists. They were partners. They lived and worked together for over 40 years. But their journey together started in Nantes in France. And it led to an amazing act of defiance.
So when you say partners, do you mean partners?
Partners, they were a couple, yeah.
They were a couple, right. Now, just to establish that, because we know it happened back then, but it wasn't as advertised as it is now, but anyway, okay. So they were a couple, okay.
Yes, they were, yeah. And they performed an amazing act of defiance, which has earned them a special and unique place in history of wartime resistance.
Okay.
But from an early age, their lives challenged, I want to say normal is not the right word. There's no such thing as
normal. No such thing as normal, no, that's true.
Exactly, no. For a start, they both adopted gender neutral pseudonyms. So Lucie became Claude Cahun in 1919, and Susan became Marcel Moore. And this decision was part of their broader exploration of identity, as well as a rejection of traditional societal norms.
Okay.
Normal. I don't think there's anything as normal as such a thing.
No.
They looked at, they're rejecting norms, themes of central stereotype perspective, really.
Right.
Who, in particular, became renowned for their very pioneering self-portraits. There's if you have a look online, you can see there's quite a series of photographs that they've adopted, many personas, trying to blur the lines between gender and challenging sticks.
They were really ahead of their time then, weren't they?
Really, as well. I think it helps that they were very intelligent people as well.
Mm.
So a lot of thought went into everything.
Mm.
Their work also encompassed writing, photo montage, and sculpture.
Right.
And so Cahun often worked in collaboration with Moore, who they referred to as the other me, so they were very, very close.
Right.
And these creations went hand in hand deeply with the principles of the surrealist movement that was in Paris at the time, which they were very active participants in for years.
Right.
Now, Claude's self-portraits were, people look back at them now, and see, they were really revolutionary for the time because they challenged those fixed notions of gender and identity long before these concepts had gained mainstream discussion, as they had done for the last few years. Through the use of elaborate costumes, masks, poses, and Cahun explored the sort of the worlds of masculinity, femininity, being androgynous, and also ambiguous personas as well. And this radical artistic practice wasn't just about the aesthetic, it was very personal and intellectual. It was a quest to dismantle these expectations that society had around identity, which made their work really relevant to modern-day discussions around gender fluidity and self-expression. So they were so far ahead of their time.
Yeah, they were. Wow.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. But In 1937, they decide we need a quarter of life. I suppose they're in their 30s now. Well, actually, they're in their 40s now, I would have thought.
All getting and on a bit. We should know about that.
You know, it's like, let me know so I know what to expect, obviously. So the idea is we can have a quieter life. We'll move somewhere away from the escalating political tensions that are happening in Europe. So they move to Jersey in the Channel Islands.
Oh.
From what I understand. Yeah, from what I understand, it was then as it is now, it was quite quiet, only with less people pulling out of buying houses, which is causing issues there, apparently. Anyway, so they moved to this lovely little place only a few years later.
It's all going to change.
We come to the summer of 1940, and the Channel Islands, which is Jersey especially, comes under direct occupation by the Nazis. So their little artistic, peaceful artistic existence is now just been dragged into the theatre of war and resistance, as we'll hear. It was only, obviously, it's a small island.
Right.
I think there was, I don't know what the population was like. I know the British didn't think they could defend it, especially at the time. So they told people that we can't help you, you need to evacuate. So hundreds and hundreds did. And stayed.
Wow.
And these two stayed. And they used their intellectual and creative courage. Over the next few years, it would be tested in very extreme circumstances. But it revealed their profound commitment to freedom, I suppose, which sort of went well above their artistic endeavours.
Yeah.
I suppose if they've been in mainland Europe prior to moving, they would have seen what was going on in Germany.
Mm.
And that sense of freedom, I suppose, would have been strengthened in most people, not just these. I mean, these two were very intelligent, and they would have thought it through quite deeply. And you'll hear exactly what they're like. They are brilliant. I heard about these two in another podcast. It was so taken with them. But it stuck with me, which is why I've then sat and written this out and trying to not bore you too much with it now.
Oh, interesting.
They're fascinating. That's brilliant.
Mm.
So, Jersey is the largest of the Channel Islands, and a little bit of peace it did enjoy during the war years came to an end on the 1st of July 1940 because the Germans just went in. It was an unchallenged occupation because the British had evacuated troops as well as people.
Right.
And it demilitarised the islands. So the German military moved in. They were there for 5 years, basically. So everyone that was left on there was under direct Nazi rule. And this made the Channel Islands the only British territory to be occupied by Germany during the Second World War.
Wow.
And if you look at photos of it, there's plenty of photos of Jersey at the time with Nazis, and you can see the police worked, I want to say, with them under the Nazis to keep the peace and probably to try and help tell people to keep their heads down.
Mm.
I can't imagine they collaborated. I imagine they did the minimum just to keep the Nazis off their backs and off other people's. But there are lots of photos, a lot of them taken secretly as well. But life under occupation immediately changed Jersey's population.
Mm.
The German military administration imposed a very strict regime, which was specifically designed to assert control and maintain order. So the basic freedoms were curtailed. So there was censorship, which became very pervasive, which affected everything from your mail to public information. They also had curfews in place. So movement was limited, especially after dark. I suppose why people out after dark, they're probably causing trouble.
Mm.
There's also shortages on most things, essentials like food and fuel, which led to severe rationing. Because the islands, obviously, they're cut off. So it's difficult for, and unless the Germans are bringing it in, no one else has been able to get anything onto the islands.
God.
They frequently confiscated property for military use, and civilians were also often used as forced labour.
Oh.
So you had this constant, visible No, it would have been quite bad. Quite bad, couldn't have been awful. I think I would upgrade it from quite
Worse
bad to
than
awful.
lockdown, it sounds like. At least we had the internet to keep us going.
Yeah, but I don't know if they were that bothered if you went out during the day, whereas here you're only allowed out for one walk a day, from what I remember. Anyway, and the Germans didn't make you stick things up your noses. They were like about the Nazis, they didn't make you stick plastic up your nose. Anyway, the constant, and it was a constant and visible presence of uniformed German troops. So as soon as you leave the house, oh yeah, we're under Nazi occupation. I don't think anyone actually woke up one morning having completely forgotten about it, but it's constantly in your face. So that psychological impact of living under enemy
And
rule
pretty much
was,
overnight
I
as
think,
well.
profound.
Like it must have been
Yeah,
quite
it just got to
a
you one day.
dramatic change.
Yeah.
Oh God, that's horrible. That's awful.
It's, I think there's one, I think they were expecting it. I know people now are expecting it, but there's a difference between expecting it and experiencing it.
Well, it's like
As
I'm not trying to
especially as
compare it, but obviously with the whole lockdown, it wasn't out of the blue. I mean, it was building and building for a long time, wasn't it? And we knew cases were going up, and we knew they were talking
yeah.
about. But the day they actually announced it and said, "Right, everyone's in lockdown," it was a shock. It was like, "Oh my God!" And life
Oh,
just
yeah.
suddenly changed, and that was nothing on this. This is completely.
And even though people were fined, was anyone imprisoned for breaking lockdown rules? They probably were. Can't remember now.
I think they were more giving people fines rather than putting them in prison. I
Yeah, there
think
was
they were
quite a
trying to
few
keep
fines,
people
weren't there?
out of
Yeah.
prison.
Yeah, it probably because it spread from prison.
Yes.
I can't remember. It's 5 years ago now, five
I'm
years.
sure it was
A few
more
days.
fines and things, but anyway, yeah.
Yeah. But, the islanders then, they experience intense isolation. Hang on. Oh, theirs was from mainland Britain, though, rather than just being stuck in a house. And your communication was very restricted as well. So the absence of news from the outside world, as well as the combination of having that with German propaganda, it fostered an environment of uncertainty and fear. I often wonder whether it's people you've been living next to for years, and all of a sudden you think, well, is he collaborating? I saw him talking to a Nazi the other day. Was he being
Yeah, you
sort
start
of this
to
whole lot, or is he
mistrust
part of a new
everyone.
country?
Yeah, it's
Yeah,
frightening.
exactly.
You don't know
It's,
who to
yeah.
trust.
No, exactly. We also have these daily imposition of German laws, as well as the constant surveillance, which creates a sense of oppression and anxiety.
Yeah.
And so that's going to change the fabric of Ireland society. It's going to, that community spirit that you've probably had beforehand is now going to be in disarray. As for, I mean, one of the laws they had, if you owned a radio or you were listening to a radio after June 1942, that was punishable by quite severe penalties, which may be imprisonment or worse.
My God.
I mean, listening to the BBC, it was more of a crime then than it is now.
When you say worse, what do you mean? Worse than prison?
Worse than imprisonment, I imagine death.
Oh my God. For having a radio.
Yes, I
It's
chances like
stressful.
yes, I imagine what they thought you were doing with that information. If they claimed the BBC was spreading propaganda and you were spreading it, then the chances are they would have seen it as a death. Yeah.
That's scary.
A reason to shoot you.
That's really bad.
And what else was bad was that the Germans saw the Channel Islands as part of their Atlantic Wall defences. So that meant putting vast resources onto the islands or taking them from the islands to build massive fortresses, which are still in existence. You can still go and see them today. So they had extensive fortifications made of like huge concrete bunkers, and there was tunnels and gun emplacements and minefields, and they were constructed right across Jersey. And this huge building project not only strengthened the Germans' presence, but it also drained local resources, and they often used forced labour of the islanders, but they also brought foreign workers on. So it's just, bear in mind, they would have gone from a lot worse, especially if they were Russians, because the Germans looked at Russian as being less than human, so they just treat them disgustingly. So, one, you'll be impressed, and now you've got these poor sods that are coming on the islands who are in a worse state than you are. From what I understand, I think some of the islanders were sneaking food to these poor sods as well. So even though you've got next to nothing, you still feel the need to share it with these people who are under the same tyranny that you are, which is, I suppose, probably helps morale somewhere.
Yeah.
Anyway, a mix.
Where do our two ladies come into this then? Because
they're living on the island. They're seeing all this, and they've decided they're going to embark upon a very extraordinary and personal campaign of resistance aimed at the German occupiers.
That's
they
brave.
Were very deeply anti-fascist. And that was convictions that they'd developed whilst they were living in Paris. And they leveraged that against their very, very artistic and intellectual talents. And they chose to actively undermine the occupying forces as basically as a self-contained two-person unit. I suppose, the church resistance would have been made up. Units made up of lots of people, and so were the Dutch, but these were a resistance unit made up by two of them under their own command, as it were. But their resistance was methodical. It was a daring, very daring act of psychological warfare. They weren't actually killing anyone, but it was psychological, and it was very meticulously planned and very meticulously executed from their own house, from the Rocket, I think it was called, which was in part of Jersey, called St. Brilade, I think. And the Roque translates roughly as the strong woman. So Rock is, Rock means rock as in strength, and the Q-U-A-I-S-E at the end of it is a feminine reference. So it's the strong woman, which was a bit of a giveaway now I think of it. So their primary, their main method of defiance involves the creation and distribution of leaflets and propaganda, all of which was subversive against the Germans. And these were, they weren't mass produced, they didn't have that ability to produce them. Maybe I assume the Nazis confiscated their photocopier, I don't know why. But the documents were carefully typed out, they were very usually hand decorated. And they were all unique creations, which demonstrated, just showed how artistic they were, this pair were. And they reportedly used their own typewriters to produce German language texts, which were then cut and glued to form small, very easily conceivable messages.
Right.
And the content was quite sophisticated. It was targeting the morale of the German soldiers as well. So instead of overt calls to violence, as you would give to the islanders, the messages used sarcasm, irony, subversion, and it drew on their very amazing understanding of propaganda techniques, probably, which they'd seen the Germans using while they were living in Paris. Because obviously, bear in mind, the Nazis got into power in 1933. They left Paris in 1937, so that's 4 years of seeing what's going on over the border.
Yeah.
They would cleverly twist excerpts from Hitler's speeches and from his own speeches against his regime. They used them against them. So it showed that they were listening to the radio, if that wasn't something the Nazis were making people listen to.
So turning their own words against them, in a way. It's quite genius, actually.
Using his words to highlight the futility of war.
Yeah.
And to appeal quite subtly to the soldiers' homesickness, as well as their disillusionment. So it reminds them of their families and friends and normal lives away from war, away from the fact that if the British invade the islands, they could be dead tomorrow. And I think if I'm a soldier, that's the one thing I'm worried about. Am I going to get shot? And they played on these, probably paranoia. Might not be the right word, but they frequently signed these communications either as the soldier with no name or the unknown soldier, which was added to the mystery, as well as the psychological pressure on the German command, because I think if you're looking at it, well, this is in German and it says the unknown soldier. Is this one of our own blokes doing this?
Yeah, that's going to, yeah. They're going to think that, aren't they? Well, they're going to consider it.
If I'm on Jersey wondering whether my neighbour's a collaborator, the Germans are now on Jersey wondering whether our own soldiers are turning against us.
Mm-hmm.
But their distribution methods, obviously they couldn't do the mass distribution, they couldn't put it through every letterbox, were as ingenious as the creation of the leaflets. And it relied on their meticulous observation of the Germans' routines.
Right.
It also took quite a degree of personal risk. I mean, the observation of German routines makes you think of the stereotype that the Germans are very economical and they're doing everything by the book, by the second.
Mm.
Great penalty takers, that's how I see them. Work hard, anyway, build a decent car. But they kept an eye on them, so they knew where and when they could bump into them if they needed to. So Hoon and Moore would venture out, often disguised, sometimes with Cahoon wearing a fake beard, would also adopting this masculine appearance to blend into population. And they would engage in very subtle acts of what would have been sabotage. Not the sabotage, we would say, they weren't blowing up railway lines, but
no.
What they would do is they would walk up and get quite close to the German soldiers and just discreetly slip one of these notes into the pockets of one of their uniforms while they were queuing at the shops or going to a concert or something, which has got a lot of guts to do that. You get
that is...
I shouldn't think about that. Yeah, that is... Love it. And I imagine if they're getting away with this time and time again, they're probably getting quite a bit of a kick from it.
Yeah, I bet they are.
They would... Oh, yeah, I think I would. They were also leaving messages on public benches in the parks, or they'd go up to the a military vehicle and leave it under a windscreen spring wiper in the town square somewhere, or tuck it into German newspapers which had been left outside cafes and newsstands to be taken in. So they walk and just put it inside one of the papers, knowing the Germans going to pick it up and read it. They also went up to elevated positions to drop the messages, knowing that they would fall somewhere near some unsuspecting German patrols. Well, they also come up with an idea of wrapping one around a stone and throwing it into a moving German military vehicle.
Oh my God, that's really brave.
Fantastic.
Jesus.
So I love these, they're fantastic. But they would also leave them in telephone boxes, public toilets.
Yeah, that's probably a bit safer.
When they knew the Germans were going. Yeah, not as much fun, but I think the idea was they probably knew the Germans might be using the phone boxes or the public toilets, so that it's... Whether it's safe or a little bit more daring, the outcome's the same. The Germans are seeing this. But what it was actually also doing is it had annoyed the German command, because there's very anonymous and sophisticated German propaganda messages have been passed to their men. And what the Germans think this is, it's a very well-organised, possibly large, entrenched resistance network on the island. So that means these two artists are now forcing Germans more manpower into looking for this cell, this group of people that they think are spreading it, because there must be more than two. They actually think there is a resistance cell on the island somewhere. So they've now taken manpower away from somewhere else to look for this soldier with no name. And this constant unidentifiable pressure.
Get your teeth in.
There you go. That's unlucky. It had undermined German morale and it forced them to expand the team to search for them. So I've always led to believe that when British soldiers were in the camps, one of the duties was to escape. So not only would escaping getting home mean they could fight again, it also meant that more the enemy would either be put into the camp to keep them there, or more the enemy would have been sent out to look at them. So while they look for them, so while they're doing that, they're not fighting. So you're just taking resources away from the front lines. And that's what these were doing.
Mm.
Absolutely brilliant. Two people really posing this significant challenge to an occupying power. But it didn't last forever, unfortunately.
I was going to say, did they get caught in the end? They were very, very brave.
They were amazing people, absolutely amazing. This audacious campaign of resistance, it was very effective in its psychological impact, its psychological warfare. Brilliant. It did carry an immense personal risk for them. And their activities intensified as the war progressed. But this meticulous discretion that they had eventually faltered. And I do wonder whether it's the fact that they keep getting away with it longer and longer and longer. It's like criminals. The more they get away with it, the more confident, overconfident and cocky they get. And sometimes they trip themselves up and get caught. I don't know how, but in July 1944, just weeks after D-Day, and with the tide of the war was turning in favour of the Allies as they were moving into Europe, Kahunamoor's luck ran out, and the Gestapo, who had spent a lot of time pursuing this anonymous soldier with no name, finally identified them, and they were arrested at their home and taken into custody. The charges that were put against them were very grave. They were accused of listening to the BBC, which is an act strictly forbidden under German occupational law, and it was punishable by severe penalties, including imprisonment. More important than that, they were facing accusations of inciting troops to rebellion, which was a charge that amounts to treason against the Reich, and this was a capital offence.
Oh dear.
It showed how deep the concern was of the German authorities about this very sophisticated and unsettling propaganda. So their imprisonment in Jersey's Newgate Street prison, was very harsh. I mean, one, it's a prison, and two, it's a prison in wartime under an occupied force. So it's going to be even worse than usual. And the conditions in there are not great at all. It was very cold, the food was terrible, and they almost certainly were in isolation. They didn't see each other, speak to each other for a while. And they were also, they were also interrogated. And this would have been by the Gestapo, and that would have been very, very unpleasant. I imagine torture techniques may have been used. They maintained their composure and never betrayed any associates. So it ensured that their two-person resistance remained that. The two-person resistance, it was isolated, it was just the two of them. So if anyone helped them, they never dropped them in it.
Oh, and that was good of them.
Yeah, amazing, absolutely amazing. It continues to be fantastic, these two. I love them. But they had a trial before German military court, which was swift because chances are the outcome was already known beforehand.
Yeah.
And in November 1944, they were sentenced to death.
Oh.
And the severity of the sentence, it showed how the German command viewed their actions as a really significant threat to military discipline on the island. Even whilst they were incarcerated, though, and they were waiting for this execution date, they continued this spirit of defiance. And Cahoon kept, she would write anti-Nazi poetry on scraps of paper smuggled into the cell, which just shows how committed they are to this, and just continually undermining the Germans.
Even while they're in prison.
Yeah, why stop? Yeah, we did it. The resilience under extreme duress was fantastic. What was good, though, is their sentences were commuted to imprisonment, so they weren't executed.
Oh,
and that
good.
Happened, yeah, that happened just before the liberation of Jersey in May 1945. So they were able to witness the end of the occupation, which they had fought against for all these years.
Yeah. Oh, at least they got to see that.
Absolutely brilliant. If you go online and look up Liberation of Jersey and look at the photos, they're brilliant. So the story, Lord and Marshall stands, is a very powerful testament to the nature of resistance during World War II, how multifaceted it is. They have unique intellectual and artistic partnership, which have been forged over decades before this, transformed into this brilliant act of defiance against the brutal reality of the of Georgia's occupation by the Nazis. As far from the conventional image of wartime heroes, these two women, through their own ingenuity and unwavering convictions, carved out their own amazing role in the fight for freedom. They had this, that little two-person army that wages psychological warfare against the Germans using their very, their handmade, crafted German language propaganda, and it sowed dissent and undermined the morale of the forces that occupying Jersey. Love it. I absolutely love this story. And they also had that brilliant distribution methods. All of a sudden, then there's this unknown soldier who's passing around propaganda. All of a sudden, one of his notes is in your pocket. How the hell did that get there? Brilliant. I love it.
Messed up everyone's heads big time.
Yes, I've just found this in my pocket. Wait, what? Where have you been? But oh, I love it. And it was a subtle, very a persistent campaign, and it earned this disproportionate attention of the Gestapo, who thought they were hunting a massive network. Which
it was just these two
effective
people.
It worked well. It was just these two artists, absolutely brilliant.
Wow.
They obviously, again, you then got their arrest in 1944, followed by a very harsh imprisonment, threat of a death sentence, which would have brought them face to face with the ultimate sacrifice that they'd made. They would have known full well what they were doing could have gotten them killed.
Yeah.
But that last minute,
and they would have known that going in, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm so pleased. It's no way the Germans could have seen it coming. They've really tripped up there. We won't excuse them. We'll keep them in prison. A few days later, they're liberated and they get to see the end of it. Brilliant.
That is good.
That's great timing. It's a shame that they go to prison in the first place. But
yeah.
That incarceration, that the whole ordeal affected Claude's health, and they died in 1954, and Marcel died in 1972.
Oh, okay.
And they've got a shared grave in Jersey.
Oh, that's.
And it's in their original names, and if you look up the photo of it, which you might have there in front of you, you'll notice above their names is the Star of David. So I'm
have a look.
Assuming.
Oh, yeah.
I'm assuming they were Jewish. Yeah, which makes it even better.
Oh, yeah, that is the Star of David, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, good on them.
Yeah, if you go to Jersey, you know, go to Jersey, you can go and look that up.
I'd like to go to Jersey, actually. We have spoken about going, so definitely would like to go and see this if we did end up going. Wow.
Yeah, I think if I ever went to Jersey, that's one thing I would be going to find.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Brilliant. Wow. Yeah, they're brilliant. So today they're rightly celebrated, not just for their groundbreaking contributions to art, which we, as we discussed earlier, was way ahead of their times. It was also for this immense bravery and this unwavering commitment to the freedom in the face of tyranny, especially if they're Jewish. They would have known that if that was found out, they were definitely for the firing squad, or were they might have been sent to camps. But it's a legacy that serves as quite an inspiring reminder that resistance can take almost any form. As I said, during the war, the British were training people, parachuting them into France to go around killing people or blowing things up. Whereas they didn't have that training, so they did what they knew. They used their art and they used their intellect to wage psychological warfare, which clearly had a huge effect. Yeah, brilliant. What an amazing pair.
Well remembered, I'm sure. Story. Well, thank you for sharing
that. That's the story of Claude Kuhn and Marcel Moore, two brilliant people.
Yeah, wow. Well, thank you for sharing that. And to our many thousands of listeners out there, thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. But just remember, we're not experts. We're just two amateurs trying to muddle our way through history.
Very muddled.